climate on long time scales is very sensitive, even to small forcings. But the human-made forcings are now dwarfing the natural forcings that drove the glacial to interglacial climate changes. So it's clear that humans are now in control of global climate, for better or worse.
Who says we have just 10 years to control our greenhouse gas dumping or face an unrecognizable planet in future generations? NASA's James Hansen, one of America's leading climate scientists. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Normally, I would never consider playing a late-night telephone call recorded from a speakerphone, but I would if it was one of the latest assessments of the threat of climate change from one of the world's leading authorities. In the first minute, the audio quality is poor, but hang in, it gets much better. And it's worth it. At first, those who have followed the climate issue may think, "Yes, I knew that." Hansen does start with a clear explanation of what we really know, and then he goes on to answer the most persistent doubters and ends up convincing anyone with a brain that our situation is perilous. The most serious threat in all the recorded history of humankind is sailing over the horizon of our consciousness. Will our leaders hear this message in time? How about you? Will you listen? Hansen's bosses, appointed by the Bush administration, obviously don't get it. NASA Administrator Michael Griffin told National Public Radio's Morning Edition that perhaps this isn't the best climate we could have or ever have had, and it would be arrogant to take steps to make sure it doesn't change. Various news stories say Griffin later apologized for making these comments, but to a closed-door meeting of NASA staff. Now we have the first response from James Hansen, the top climate scientist at the Goddard Space Center. This was delivered by telephone from Sweden to a waiting audience in Australia. It was 2 a.m. when Hansen spoke. James Hansen opened the Zero Emissions Conference with this speech to a full house at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, on June 30, 2007. The first minute of the speech was not properly recorded. Here is what Hansen said, quote, "I'd like to point out that there is a large gap between what is understood about global warming and what is known about global warming. I mean, what is understood by the relevant scientific community and what is known by the people who need to know, and that's the public policy makers. Part of the reason for this is that the chronic problem differs from the previous global solution problems, in the sense that..." And now we go to James Hansen's speech, and remember, the quality improves in just a minute.
"In the sense that we don't see the effect immediately upon the emission of the gases, because of the inertia, the thermal inertia of the ocean, which is 4 kilometers deep and has a response time of several decades before we see, 50 or 60% of the equilibrium response. So there's more global warming in the pipeline due to the gases that are already in the atmosphere. About half of that effect is still to occur. And we also realize that there are positive feedbacks. The climate system, it turns out, is very sensitive to forcings because positive feedbacks predominate. And the result is, when you combine the fact that we have infrastructure that has a long time constants, the power plants and vehicles, we're at a point where it really is a crisis, because the danger is that we're close to passing tipping points. We're close to a point where the rest of the Arctic sea ice can disappear quite rapidly. And we're close to the point where the West Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet could become unstable and begin to disintegrate out of our control. Could I have the next chart? And this is a little hard for people to understand, because this is the global warming to date, which is in the last 100 years, which is about 0.8 degrees Celsius. 3/4 of that warming has occurred in the last 30 years. But that's small compared with weather variations. The temperature depends a lot more upon whether the wind is blowing from the north or whether it's blowing from the south than it does upon the changes of these greenhouse gases. But if I could have the next chart. And even if you average the temperature anomalies over a month, and these are maps of temperature anomalies relative to the base period 1951 to 1980 when many of us grew up. So reds and yellows are warmer than that base period, and blues are colder than the average for that base period. And you can see that at a given place, it might be warmer or colder than normal, even when you average over a month. But if you go to the next chart, which shows the average temperature anomaly for the first 6 years of this century, then the patterns begin to make a lot more sense from a scientific standpoint. The warming looks just like what we expect. It's larger over the land than it is over the ocean because the thermal inertia of the ocean makes the response there smaller to date. And the warming is larger at high latitudes than it is at low latitudes because of the positive feedbacks at high latitudes, especially the ice snow albedo feedback, which is a positive feedback because as you melt the ice and snow, the surface underneath is darker and absorbs more sunlight. And also the warming is larger in the northern hemisphere than it is in the southern hemisphere because you've got more ocean in the southern hemisphere and the ocean around Antarctica mixes quite deeply, so that the warming there is rather small. And of course humans don't, a person doesn't tend to average the temperature over the last 6 years, but you can see that it makes a lot of sense. So let's go to the next chart. Now, I don't know how many of you are scientists and are used to looking at graphs and charts, but I'd like to show this one, which is a little complicated, because I think it's helpful. Recently the NASA administrator said that it was arrogant of us to think humans could control climate when we know that in the past the natural world has had much larger variations of climate. And of course that's true. There have been very large changes of climate in the past. But nevertheless, humans are now completely in control of global climate, and I'd like to try to make that clear. What this shows is the oxygen 18 isotope measured in ocean sediments around many different places around the world ocean. And at the times before there were ice sheets on the planet, the oxygen 18 isotope provided a measure. This is the oxygen in foraminifera shells, microscopic animals that lived in the deep ocean, and when they die, their shells sink to the bottom, and you have these layers of sediments, and by taking a core, you can sample the composition of these shells for the last 65 million years in this case. And you can see that over that time period, the ocean has been becoming colder. It's about 10 degrees Celsius colder now than it was 50 or 60 million years ago. When we get into this period beginning about 35 million years ago, when the first ice began to appear on East Antarctica, then this oxygen isotope depends upon how much water is locked in those ice sheets. So it becomes a little more complicated on the black part of the curve. There are two variables that affect it. But the point is, what's happening here is in this time period, normally there's a balance between the carbon dioxide put in the atmosphere by volcanoes going off and carbon dioxide removed from the atmosphere by weathering, which converts the carbon dioxide to carbonate rocks, and you have a balance of that. But what's happening in the last, in the recent times, last 50 or 60 million years, is there's been strong orogeny, mountain building, because of the motion of the plates, the continental plates, and in particular, the Indian plate has been crashing up against the Asian plate and causing the Himalaya mountains to rise up, and the South America, you know, the Andes have been rising at a rate of about 1 millimeter per year, which may not sound like a lot, but that's 1 kilometer in a million years. And so this rather rapid mountain building has caused CO2 to in the atmosphere to decrease. We don't have a very accurate measure of what it was 50 million years ago, but it's probably of the order of 1,000 parts per million. It's now about 380 some parts per million. But let's but this is of course a long time period. Let's look at the right piece of this diagram in the next chart. So if you have the right chart up, it should have 3.5 million years, the most recent 3.5 million years. And as you can see, the oxygen isotope continued to decrease or increase during this time period, which means that the temperature has been decreasing and sea level has been decreasing during that time period. And it has these, you can see, a very regular fluctuations. Those are rather strong climate fluctuations, and they have a, for most of that period, they have a regular 41,000-year periodicity. It gets a little more complicated in the last million years for reasons that we understand. I don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but let's go to the next chart, which the time period that we can really analyze these climate changes very well is the last 400,000 years, actually 700,000 years with the new ice cores. But this is the time in which we can analyze from the ice cores on Greenland and Antarctica. The Antarctic ice sheet is formed by snowfall piling up year after year and being compressed into ice as it gets thicker. And when we drill a core through that, we can sample the composition of the ice, and from the isotopic composition of the H and the oxygen, we can deduce the temperature at which the snowflakes formed. But also, when the snowflakes are compressed into ice, they trap bubbles of air, so we can sample the atmospheric composition that existed throughout this time period. And what we see is that the temperature between the interglacial periods, and on the far right we have the Holocene, which is the, you know, the humans, well, Homo sapiens existed for maybe 150,000 to 200,000 years, so that's the right half of this diagram. But civilization really developed in the last several thousand years, during the Holocene period, which is now almost 12,000 years long. So we've lived in this period of climate stability. Or humans have existed in this period. 20,000 years ago, the last ice age, it was... how much time have I used so far, by the way?
You're fine. Continue on.
Okay, but...
Everyone's most engaged.
Okay. Now, so 20,000 years ago, the depth of the last ice age, it was 8 degrees Celsius colder than during the current interglacial. And typically, 10-degree variation between the warm interglacial periods and the depths of the ice ages. At the poles, But at the equator, the temperature variations from ice age to interglacial are about 3 to 4 degrees, and on the global average, they're about 5 degrees. Now, if we go to the next chart, we can understand quantitatively what the direct cause of these temperature changes was. One of the causes is the greenhouse gases. You can see this graph shows the carbon dioxide and the methane, how they varied over this same time period. And you can see there's a high correlation with these gases with the temperature. The other thing, and the nitrous oxide also varied in a similar way. Those are the long-lived greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. But in addition, what was changing is the area of ice sheets on the planet. And so the surface conditions, also the amount, the vegetation distribution, and even the coastline, because the sea level was changing by between the glacial and interglacial times by about 100 meters. So if you go to the next chart, we can tell how big the ice sheets were because we have measures of the sea level throughout this time period. And so we can calculate quite accurately the climate forcing due to both the greenhouse gas changes and the surface changes on the planet. The climate forcing is a change of the, it's an imposed change of the planet's energy balance with space, which would tend to alter the Earth's temperature. And the greenhouse gases work by making the atmosphere more opaque in the thermal region of the spectrum where the Earth's heat radiation is radiated. So if the atmosphere is more opaque, the radiation to space emerges from a higher level where it's colder. And therefore, in effect, these greenhouse gases trap the heat radiation, and so they're a positive forcing when you get more greenhouse gases. And ice sheets, as they get bigger, reflect more sunlight. So we can, and from the size of the ice sheets and from the amount of the greenhouse gases, we can calculate the forcings, and if we just multiply these forcings by the climate sensitivity, which we obtain both from climate models and from just looking at two points on the in the Earth's history, say the current interglacial period and the depth of the last ice age, and we infer that the sensitivity of the system is about 3/4 of a degree for each watt of forcing. And then what the bottom curve shows you is that that sensitivity, this bottom curve called calculated temperature, is simply multiplying 3/4 of a degree for each watt by the number of watts in the climate forcings due to these two mechanisms. And what we see is that those two mechanisms account for the global temperature changes. So we go to the next chart. However, the interesting thing is that those two mechanisms are both slightly trailing the temperature change. They're virtually simultaneous, as you can see in this chart, where I have graphed the greenhouse gas forcing and the temperature. And you can see they're in remarkable correspondence, but the temperature change leads the greenhouse gas change by several hundred years on the average. So what this tells us is that, and the same is true with the ice sheets, so both of these mechanisms are feedbacks, but they are indeed the causes, the primary causes of the temperature change, but they're doing it as feedbacks. And what is instigating these fluctuations from ice age to interglacial period is very weak forcings due to the Earth's orbital changes. We see the next chart, the one showing the Earth's spin axis, which is tilted by about 23.5 degrees to the plane of the Earth's orbit or about the Sun, that tilt of the spin axis fluctuates from 22.5 to 24.5 degrees, the perturbations being caused by the other planets, Jupiter and Saturn, tug at the Earth, and they're very heavy, and Venus comes very close, and we can calculate the perturbations of the Earth's orbit. This is one of the perturbations. Also, the orbit is sometimes nearly circular and sometimes it's elliptical, up to about 6% eccentricity. But this variation of the spin axis orientation is very regular at about 41,000 year periodicity, and it's exactly in the variations that I showed you on an earlier chart for the Earth's temperature and the sea level. Point I wanted to make was, let's go to the next chart. This again is showing the variations of temperature over the last 3.5 million years. And as I was saying, these variations, up until the last million years, they were at a 41,000 year periodicity. The point is that when the tilt is larger, you're exposing both Antarctica and the North Pole to more sunlight at 6 month separations. So when the tilt is larger, the ice melts and the sea level goes up. And that's exactly what we see in the record. And then when you get closer to the recent times, it got a little more complicated because a big ice sheet grew in North America, and there was no way that a similar ice sheet could grow in the southern hemisphere because you had no land at the same latitude. So it became asymmetric, and then this eccentricity of the Earth's orbit also comes into play. But we don't really have time to talk about that in detail. But let's go to the next chart. Now this should be the chart that's showing the current recent times expanded. The time scale is expanded on the right and shows that carbon dioxide and methane are now increasing off the chart almost. And of course, these are the anthropogenic effects, primarily from fossil fuel burning. But we've now driven the amounts of these greenhouse gases far outside the range that has existed in hundreds of thousands of years. And we're even approaching the amount of CO2 that existed during the Pliocene a few million years ago. Let's go to the next chart. So the implications of the paleoclimate information is climate on long time scales is very sensitive, even to small forcings. But the human-made forcings are now dwarfing the natural forcings that drove the glacial to interglacial climate changes. So it's clear that humans are now in control of global climate, for better or worse. Now the next chart, and we understand this reasonably well quantitatively. I mean, if we make simulations of the Earth's temperature for the last century and put in the changes in greenhouse gases. And over that time period, there are other forcings that are not negligible. And I don't have time to go through all of the climate modeling business and all of the forcings, but the volcanoes are pretty, we have quite accurate measurements of stratospheric aerosols by volcanoes, and those cause a cooling effect whenever big volcanoes go off. There are also human-made aerosols in the troposphere, which we don't have as good measurements of. But with our best estimates for that and using a model that has a climate sensitivity that's consistent with the paleoclimate evidence for climate sensitivity, we get good agreement with the observed temperatures in the last century, the observations being the green line. And we can then project into the future for different assumptions about increasing greenhouse gases. And the dark blue lines, like A1B, that's a typical business as usual IPCC scenario. And it's consistent with the growth rates in CO2 emissions that we've had in recent decades. I have also there what I call an alternative scenario, in which I assume that we will begin to slow down the emissions of the greenhouse gases and actually get methane to decrease substantially. And that scenario was designed to keep the additional forcing in the next century less than about 1.5 watts, and that would keep additional global warming less than 1 degree, which was a rough idea of what we thought might constitute dangerous human interference.
You are listening to an important speech by James Hansen, the top NASA climate scientist, delivered by telephone from Sweden to an audience in Australia on June 30, 2007. It was the opening of the Zero Emissions Conference, a full house at RMIT University in Melbourne. Hansen clearly describes the ultimate threat posed by global warming and our need to act quickly or face a life on a vastly different planet. This is Radio EcoShock.
Let's go to the next chart, because the reason for trying to understand what is the level of global warming that is dangerous is all countries, or 160 nations or so, have agreed on this framework convention on climate change that we should stabilize emissions at a level that prevents dangerous interference with the climate system. So if I go to the next chart, so what is dangerous? Well, I think that the two things that are perhaps most important in defining that are ice sheet disintegration, because that would be irreversible on any time scale of interest to humanity. It takes tens of thousands of years to regrow an ice sheet. And the other thing is, of course, extermination of species, which is also irreversible. And not to downgrade the regional climate changes, which are also can be very important to in different places, and also things like acidification of the ocean are important. Let's go to the next chart. And the point is, so then the question is, well, what amount of global warming would be dangerous? And again, I think the best measure for that, best information we have, is to look at the history of the Earth. And what we see is that the warming that has occurred in the last century, and especially in the last 30 years, has taken temperature back up to perhaps the highest in the Holocene, at least comparable to the warmest time in the Holocene 6,000 or 8,000 years ago. And it's not as warm as the warmest interglacial periods. There were prior interglacial periods that were warmer. This particular graph is for the Western Equatorial Pacific, because that's, if you want to look at a single place on the planet, this may be the most important one to look at, because it's the warmest ocean on the planet, and it influences the heat transport to higher latitudes in both hemispheres and by both ocean and atmosphere. But we're within 1 degree of the warmest interglacial periods. And if we want to find a time that's 2 to 3 degrees warmer, we have to go back to the Pliocene, when it was a very different planet. There was no sea ice in the Arctic, and sea level was about 25 meters higher. So 2 or 3 degrees warming, I think, is clearly dangerous and be crazy for us to allow the system to go there if we can avoid that. Could have the next chart. So, and of course, in the case of ice sheets and sea level, there's a big uncertainty in how long it takes them to respond. But again, I think there's a lot of evidence that has come to the fore in the last several years, mostly from the paleoclimate data as we get more specific data, and also from what we actually see happening, beginning to happen on the ice sheets, which is surprising a lot of people. But for one thing, the summer melt, the area with summer melt has been increasing both on Greenland and West Antarctica, as shown in this chart. And then if we go to the next one, it has this picture of when you get the summer melt, and to some degree that's always been occurring, but the area in which it's occurring and the amount of it is increasing. But it doesn't go off the edge of the ice sheet. It finds a low spot and burrows a hole all the way through the ice sheet to the base of the ice sheet, and that lubricates the base of the ice sheet and helps it move downslope toward the ocean more rapidly. And the next chart shows these giant icebergs being discharged to the ocean. The speed of these ice streams has doubled on Greenland in the last 5 or 6 years. And if I could have the next chart, then there was disagreement as to whether the increased snowfall due to the warming atmosphere was more important than the increased melting. Well, we now have these fantastic measurements from GRACE, the gravity satellite, which measures the gravitational field of the Earth with such high precision that we can measure the mass of the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet. And what we find is that, well, during the winter, the ice sheet gets heavier, and then during the spring and summer, it loses mass. But the net effect in the last few years since this satellite began to take measurements has been a decrease in mass of about 150 cubic kilometers per year, which is, you know, it's not a huge amount yet, but well, sea level is now going up at a rate of about 3.5 centimeters per decade, or 35 centimeters per century, but that's double what it was a few decades ago, a couple decades ago, and it's four times what it was a century ago. And the concern is that when ice sheets begin to disintegrate, it's a very nonlinear process, and there are multiple positive feedbacks. So you could reach a point where you begin to have very rapid ice sheet disintegration. And again, the paleoclimate record tells us that when ice sheets have disintegrated in the past, sea level has gone up rapidly. The last time, 14,000 years ago, sea level went up at a rate of, it went up 20 meters in 400 years, which is 1 meter every 20 years. So ice sheets can disintegrate rapidly once they get started. And if we went to the sea level of the, if I could have the next chart that shows sea level, this should be the one with four parts that has the areas underwater. That's the areas that would be underwater if we got the 25-meter change in sea level that existed 3 million years ago. There would be 250 million people in China that would be underwater with 25 meters. But the entire nation of Bangladesh and almost the entire state of Florida. So it's really a big deal. And in fact, you don't have to go, we wouldn't expect that big a sea level change even in a century, but you could get sea level change of meters in a century. And that alone is enough to be disastrous for tens of millions of people. Then, just a few, we go to the next chart on extermination of species. Species are already under stress for a number of reasons that humans are mainly responsible for. But climate change, if it followed business as usual, would be a tremendous additional stress on species. The rate of movement of an isotherm now in the, at least in the northern hemisphere land areas, is about 50 to 60 kilometers per decade. And species will migrate to stay within the climatic zones that they can survive in. But there are limits as to if you continue to, could I have the next chart? Well, I'll just summarize by saying that the polar species were tending to push off the planet because there's no place colder for them to go. And also alpine species, as the isotherms move up the mountain, we will be pushing off the planet those species that live at high altitudes. And this is a particular example of a species that's under threat. In the next chart, I have a polar bear as an example of a high-latitude species. But, again, if you look at the paleoclimate record, there have been large warmings several times in the Earth's history, which resulted, and these were typically 6 to 8 degrees Celsius warming, and resulted in the extermination of more than 90% of the species on the planet. And that's probably larger warming than I hope we will get due to human gases. But the human forcing is actually much more rapid. And the other variable that's different now is that humans have erected barriers to the movement of species. So, and there are natural barriers also for Australia. Of course, you've got coastlines. So I think global warming of a few degrees is going to be cause the extermination of many species. And then there are regional things, and but let's go to talking about the solutions. So the next chart should be the one on carbon cycle.
Yeah.
It's an important point, which is not realized by everybody, is that the decay, when humans put a pulse of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the decay of that is initially quite rapid. So 50% of it will get taken up, mostly by the ocean, but it's taken up within about 25 years. But after a century, a third of the pulse is still in the atmosphere. And after 500 years, almost a quarter of it is still in the atmosphere. The reason is that the CO2 that goes into the ocean, in effect, exerts a back pressure on the atmosphere and doesn't let in more CO2 until it, you get deep mixing. But then even when the ocean's mixed, until the CO2 is taken out by sedimentation, which takes formation of rocks, sediments with carbon, which takes hundreds of thousands of years, you're going to have part of the human emissions still in the atmosphere. And 500 years for, you know, is eternity, is for all practical purposes, for human purposes. So then this question of the size of the fossil fuel reservoirs becomes an important boundary condition. Because if you look at the amount of carbon in the oil and gas, that's enough to put us up to something of the order of 450 parts per million, which is enough to put us up to, I think, the dangerous level. It'll put us up to, you know, so we get more than a degree of additional warming.
You are listening to an important speech by James Hansen, the top NASA climate scientist. delivered by telephone from Sweden to an audience in Australia on June 30, 2007. It was the opening of the Zero Emissions Conference, a full house at RMIT University in Melbourne. Hansen clearly describes the ultimate threat posed by global warming and our need to act quickly or face a life on a vastly different planet. This is Radio EcoShock.
What this tells us, I think, and you know, it's going to be very hard to prevent the use of oil. You can't tell Saudi Arabia not to drill for its oil. And that is used in mobile sources. It's impractical to capture the CO2. But what we could do is decide that we're not going to use coal except in power plants where we capture the CO2 and sequester it, and put the same constraint on these unconventional fossil fuels. If I could go to the next chart, well, that's a repetition. Go on two charts to this outline of a solution. I think technically it's possible to keep CO2 at 450 or less. It would require that we phase out the old technology coal use and use it only where we capture it and sequester it. Phase it out over the next few decades. And also, though, it's important to stretch the conventional oil and gas, because otherwise, if we just keep burning more and more each year, we're going to have to, there won't be time to develop the technology for going beyond petroleum era. I mean, there's pressure then to make liquid fuels out of coal or out of unconventional fossil fuels. So I think that it's essential to have a price on carbon emissions as well as efficiency standards. And in that way, that would be a natural way to avoid the mining of these unconventional fossil fuels like tar shale, which is just incredibly energy intensive to cook the Rocky Mountains and drip oil out of them. But if there's a tax, and it results in such a high amount of carbon going into the atmosphere. And then I think there, the other two points are that the other forcings are not negligible. Right now, the CO2 forcing is about the same as the sum of all the non-CO2 forcings. And some of these, we could reduce the absolute amount in the atmosphere, and it would make a lot of sense because it would reduce air pollution, and especially in places like China and India, it would be a great boon. I suspect that we're going to get to the point where we actually realize that we've overshot, that we've got too much CO2 in the atmosphere, and we're going to have to try to draw some of it out. And if it's only a little bit of an overshoot, then it's practical to do that by means of improved agriculture and forestry practices. And if I go to the next chart, I write as a former resident of Iowa, I like the idea of the Midwest in the U.S. coming to the rescue of the coastal states. But you could burn biofuels in power plants, capture the CO2 and sequester it, and in that way you would draw down the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And to a limited extent, that could help. But if I go to the next chart, it has the pie charts. There's one important point. Although China is now passing the U.S. and may have caught us in 2006, and if they didn't, they will in 2007, because their emissions are going up rapidly. But it's not the current emissions that determine the climate change. Because of the long life of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's the cumulative emissions that count. And so the U.S. is responsible for more than three times the climate change of any other nation. And that will continue to be true for decades, even when China is emitting more than the U.S. But as I show in a bar graph on the bottom, Canada and Australia are about equally as bad as the U.S. in terms of per capita contributions to the climate problem. So in summary, on my last chart, well, I think that technically it's still possible to avoid the disastrous changes that I think would accompany business as usual, but we're not on that path. The emissions are, even though there's a lot of talk about this problem, the emissions are increasing every year, and in the last few years by just as much as they have in the past few decades. So although I think it's technically feasible to get on this alternative scenario and keep warming less than 1 degree, it's not happening. And if we stay on this path for even another 10 years, then by 2015, the emissions will be 35% higher than they were in 2000. And this alternative scenario assumes that by middle of the century, you're a few tens of percent less than in year 2000. So given the infrastructure that would be in place for power plants and vehicles and everything, it just would be impractical, if not impossible, to get back on this alternative scenario. So I think the problem is really becoming urgent. And that's the end of my story.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, James, are you still there?
Sure.
Would it be okay to take a couple of quick questions? We'll relay them
to
you.
Sure, that'd be fine.
Okay. We've got one up at the back. Yep.
In Australia, a lot of the green groups are spending a lot of time protesting against the so-called clean coal, which involves carbon sequestration and nuclear. What would your thoughts be on the efforts that are going into that?
Okay, the question was, in Australia, a lot of efforts from green groups have been put into challenging the notion of clean coal and the idea of building those plants and spending money in that way. What's your thoughts?
And nuclear.
And nuclear. And what's your thought on their efforts? Are they wasting their time?
Clean coal, you know, President Bush describes as clean coal, I would protest against too, because it's until you, there are a lot of bad things in coal besides CO2, mercury, and that's the problem with this. The Chinese plants are really dirty and they're polluting the whole ocean and going to affect fish for everybody in the world. But it is possible, I think, to have clean coal, and I think there was a paper last year by House et al. At Harvard, which makes the point that if you sequester the CO2 beneath ocean sediments, it's inherently stable there, so you don't have to worry about it leaking out. In effect, we're putting it back underground where it came from. And so I think it is possible to have clean coal. But it does have to be really clean coal, so it depends on what you mean by that. But it should have to compete against efficiency and renewable energies. And the way you do that is put an appropriate price on carbon. And in that case, I think renewables and efficiency are, there's a tremendous potential in these, and it's not being realized because right now we're not only not putting a price on carbon, we are subsidizing these fossil fuels in many countries. So I don't see any inherent problem with clean coal. I would let it compete. But I don't. It may not do so well in that competition if it has to pay its appropriate price. Now, nuclear is another issue. That's up to. I think that the new technology, nuclear, can be much safer as far as plant, you know, having release of radioactive materials due to accidents. But there are other problems with nuclear, including the possibility, the waste disposal problem, and the fact that you don't want terrorists to get their hand on the material. So it becomes a matter of individual countries deciding on what they want to do. But what I object to is, for example, in Germany, they decided they don't want nuclear, but instead they're making coal-fired power plants that do not capture the CO2. So they still don't get it, even though their leaders supposedly understand this problem. We cannot burn all of the coal or we're done for. We'll be back to it. All of that has been in the atmosphere for tens of millions of years. You'll be talking about a completely different planet if we burn the coal without sequestration.
Can I grab one more question?
Yep.
Now, at the beginning of the presentation, there's a notion of the gap between what the scientists understand and what the public and policy makers know. And given that if you look at the political elite, for want of a better term, a lot of them either don't want to listen or they hear it but they think there's nothing that they can realistically do about it, I want to put, why don't scientists like James Goddard form their own political party or movement? Because you'd certainly get the moral high ground.
Okay, James, the question was, you know, at the beginning you put that there's what where the scientists are at and what the public know, and the gap between what our political leaders are doing, and the question was why don't people like yourselves form your own political movement and bring that to the people, and that was the question.
I do think we have to do a better job of informing them. And I think that, you know, we have this special problem that politicians like to get reelected and they tend to require donations. I don't know if it's true in Australia, but in the United States it certainly is true that special interests have undue influence. And I think the public has got to make clear to the politicians that this is a high priority, and then they may begin to respond. But I don't know, it's a hard problem. I think Al Gore's movie has done some good in trying to educate and reduce this gap, but then many people consider that political, so it's a hard problem. I don't know. I don't have the answers.
Okay.
Just take one more question, and that will be the last one.
You mentioned biofuels. Do you think that kind of thing is feasible, considering there's obvious limits on the world's agricultural output?
Okay, you mentioned biofuels. Do you think that kind of solution is feasible, given the limits on the agricultural output of the world and obviously the requirements for food production, things like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I should make clear that, boy, there are some biofuels and then there are others. What's being planned in the U.S. right now is a disaster. Corn-based ethanol is going, if they really make the amount that they're talking about, it's going to take land that's been put out of production, marginal land that has been, they've been starting to grow natural grasses and trees on, and then plow it up for corn, and you fertilize that, and it has many problems, and it raises the price of food worldwide. It just doesn't make sense. What I was talking about was using natural grasses and cellulosic fibers, things which you could do with no-till agriculture and which would not compete with food. And then I think you can do a limited amount that way, but you cannot replace. Vehicles are going to have to find a non-petroleum, non-CO2 way of propulsion in the future. We've got to go beyond that, and you can't say that there's just not enough land area to provide all of that fuel for vehicles.
All right, great. Thanks very much for helping us out at 2 a.m. in the morning in Sweden. I'm sure everybody here appreciates it. And good luck and keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
From Sweden to Australia, in a late-night telephone call recorded by speakerphone, that was top NASA climate scientist Dr. James Hansen. This was his first speech following a wild statement by his boss, Michael Griffin, that it would be arrogant for humans to try and save their climate. Hansen lays out what we know about climate change. He describes a delicate system that moves between extremes of cold and heat over the ages, in part due to long cycles of variation in the Earth's angle and trajectory. However, it now appears that humans have triggered this change by dumping billions of tons of greenhouse gases into a sensitive atmosphere. James Hansen says we have only 10 years to act before positive feedback loops take away any human ability to prevent extreme climate change. This speech was delivered long distance to the Zero Emissions Conference, the full house at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. It was passed on to us by Ratbag Radio and digitally remastered for radio by Radio EcoShock. You can download this speech from the climate section of our audio on demand menu at the website www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock.org. And tune in to our 24-hour net radio site for more information about your world, commercial-free green radio.